The case will be taken under advisement. Our next case this morning is number 053510, Rita McConville against the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Nickmeyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Kent Nickmeyer. I represent the petitioner, Rita McConville. On March 20th of 2001, Acorn's Board of Directors terminated my client's status as an officer of Acorn. She had been the CFO and Secretary of Acorn up to that point in time. From March 20th, 2001 forward, she occupied no such position. A month later, on April 17, 2001, Acorn filed a 10-K with the Commission. My client didn't sign Acorn's 10-K. She didn't file Acorn's 10-K. She didn't ask, tell, or authorize anyone to file Acorn's 10-K. McConville wasn't even given a copy of Acorn's 10-K to review before Acorn filed it. The Commission now claims that when Acorn filed Acorn's 10-K, Rule 10b-5 and Section 10b of the 34 Act were violated.
Right, because your history started not back in December 2000 when she got the financial statements that showed things were really shaky. She had those financial statements. I mean, the complete scenario was not outlined in your presentation. And then in January 2001, the sales, earnings, and figures were extracted from the core financial statements, and that was when she was in charge, correct? And then the press release was drafted by her. And the press release announced profits of $2 million. So, I mean, there is a little more to the story. I'm just saying, because 3 days, and you correct me if I'm wrong, only 3 days passed between when the press release was issued and when the auditor completed research for the Form 10-K.
Your Honor, it's correct that 3 days passed between the time the press release was issued and the time the auditors completed their field work.
Right.
The auditors had been doing that field work from, I believe it began in September of 2000.
Right. But in December 2000, the core financial statements that she presented to the board and the audit committee were inaccurate.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. The Commission's expert witness, Mr. Gordon, testified that the reason the financial statements, as published in the 10-K, were incorrect in accordance with GAAP was because during the week preceding the filing of the 10-K, information came to the attention of Acorn's management suggesting that there were $573,000 worth of rebates and chargebacks that hadn't been processed for the year 2000. And he testified, and that was the only testimony on this point, that that piece of information should have caused Acorn to question whether or not there was an impairment of its accounts receivable as of the time that it filed the 10-K.
Well, let me just get clear in my mind then. Is it your position that the February press release was accurate, totally accurate, didn't include material misleading statements?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position, and that's the position of the Commission also. The Commission has never charged that February 20th press release was in any way false, misleading, or even a shade inaccurate at the time it was released. The critical thing that the court has to understand is that what we're dealing with here in accounting parlance is a dynamic situation, and things are evaluated on a continuum. What we are dealing with is an estimate of what will happen in the future. What will happen? Will Acorn's debtors, these wholesalers, pay Acorn the amounts that Acorn billed them? Nobody contends in this case that Acorn was cooking its books in terms of putting on its books invoices that weren't related to goods that were shipped. Nobody contends that Acorn was cooking its books in terms of putting in its invoices charges that it didn't expect to collect, because those charges were consistent with the agreements it made with the wholesalers. The question here is whether at some point Acorn made a decision that because of other factors relating to its relationships with its suppliers, it wanted to renegotiate the payment terms, it wanted to resolve issues relating to the computation of discounts. It had a whole series of things that it wanted to take up with its wholesalers after new management came into place in March of 2001. They started negotiations with the wholesalers on April 25th of 2001, dealing with those issues. That was 7 days after the 10-K was filed. And it was only after those negotiations got further along that Acorn's management realized that it was not going to be able to successfully negotiate on the points that were most critical to it going forward and still maintain a collegial relationship and press these debtors for payments that were due. And so Acorn chose in May of 2001 to make a change in its estimate, not charge off, a change in its estimate of what it would collect going forward. And even today, nobody knows whether that change of estimate, even under the facts, the changed circumstances created by management's decision, was good or bad, because the record doesn't reflect what portion of Acorn's accounts receivable reported in the 10-Q for the first quarter were ultimately collected.
Well, let me just also try to get some other facts straight. In February 2000, didn't Acorn's auditors report to her that the accounting books were in disarray as a result of mismanagement and suggested changes to correct the problem? No changes were made. And so when the core financial statements were put together, those errors were still included in the core financial statements under her leadership. Are you saying that's inaccurate, that my understanding of the facts there is incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is. There are two different aspects of Acorn's accounting records that are in play here. One are the ledger accounts, which are the sources of information that go into the published financial statements. Nobody has ever contended or put in evidence a single shred of documentation showing that at the ledger, general ledger level, Acorn's accounts were not accurate. What is the case, and what the auditors noted, and the auditors having noted it, ultimately signed off and said that the financial statements as presented conform to GAAP, fairly and accurately presented in accordance with GAAP, the problem was at the subledger account level. Mm-hmm. And that problem arose because of the volume of information that was being dealt with by a computer system that just wasn't up to the task. And there were steps being taken to remedy that situation.
So at that sub-level, they were inaccurate.
They were not inaccurate.
And there were problems with the numbers.
There certainly were problems with those numbers insofar as they affected the management of the accounts receivable. It made it difficult for Acorn to go to its customers and say, here's what you owe us, pay up, because they had to go through a great deal of effort to figure out exactly what the status of those accounts were.
Nonetheless, in the press release, even knowing that there were problems with these numbers, Acorn represented that they were making $2 million in profits.
Acorn published financial statements showing that for the year 2000, they had made $2 million in profits. Those same financial statements showed that in the fourth quarter of 2000, they took a huge loss.
Right.
The question is not whether that $2 million figure was correct or not, because the commission hasn't even contended now, at least as of this point, that in April, on April 17th of 2001, Acorn actually should have published a $2 million loss figure in the 10-K. It alleged that in the OIP, and that was the basis for the charge made in the OIP, but after the evidence came in at the hearing and the commission's expert witness declined to buy into that theory and said, no, there wasn't enough information to calculate what kind of financial effect this impairment might have. So what was required under GAAP, according to this witness, was that Acorn include a footnote in its financial statements saying, there's an impairment out here. We don't know what we're actually going to collect in these accounts receivable. It's very interesting because there are actually two places in the 10-K when Acorn said, in substance, that's the case. In the first couple of pages of the 10-K, Acorn talks about future forward-looking statements and risks to the accuracy of the financial statements that were in there. And the accounts receivable allowance for doubtful accounts is specifically identified there, and then again in footnote A to the financial statements as a risk area. And it's described as being a material estimate that may or may not be correct, and which, if not correct in the final event, may have a material adverse effect on Acorn's financial situation. That's right in the 10-K. Now, this footnote would have gone a little bit further than that if it had been included in there. But the question before this court and the question that was before the commission is whether Rita McConville was responsible for putting that footnote in the 10-K. And the commission said there was an omission in the 10-K, so the question before this court is, on April 17th of 2001, what duty did Rita McConville have to speak? She had none. She had no office with Acorn. She didn't sign the document. She didn't tell anybody else to sign the document. And she didn't say, let's push the button, it's ready to go. She didn't even see the document. So how can it be that she's responsible? How can it be that she, in the words of the commission in its brief at page 22, did what was necessary to violate 10K or 10B and Rule 10B-5 when Acorn, not McConville, Acorn filed the 10K. The commission says it had to prove McConville, one, made a misstatement or omission, two, of a material fact, three, with scienter, four, in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Goes on to concede that the misleading statement must also have been made by use of the jurisdictional means. But we can start with the last item. How did Rita McConville use the jurisdictional means on April 17, 2001? She didn't. She didn't directly or indirectly do that because she didn't do it herself and she didn't ask anybody or tell anybody to do it. How did she make a statement when Acorn filed a 10-K? She didn't. She didn't do it directly or indirectly because she didn't sign it, she didn't file it, she didn't tell anybody to do it. Central Bank teaches us that in order to violate Rule 10B, you have to be a primary actor. Rita McConville was not a primary actor, and this court doesn't even need to get to the question of whether or not the 10K actually contained a false or misleading statement of material fact in order to determine that the commission's charge that she violated 10B and Rule 10B-5 is just wrong, it's unsustainable as a matter of fact or as a matter of law. But when we look at the question of whether or not that 10K actually contained a material misrepresentation of fact, not opinion, fact, we find that the commission's case actually depends upon an opinion. a judgment by people about what would happen in the future. And the 10-K, as I've already said, clearly disclosed that. More importantly, when we get to the issue of scienter, and I say more importantly because this goes into the 13B2 charge that Ms. McConville has supposedly lied to Acorn's auditors, there was no evidence that Ms. McConville ever, until Acorn's new management changed course in May of 2001, that Rita McConville ever thought that the estimate of Acorn's uncollectible accounts in the 10-K was an unreasonable, unrealistic, or an incorrect estimate. There is not any evidence. There's none of the traditional evidence of scienter. She wasn't out trading Acorn securities, selling securities in order to profit by what she should have concluded was an inflated price if she believed that indeed the accounts receivable allowance for doubtful accounts was understated. There is no evidence that my client did anything like that. There is no evidence that on April 17th or at any time before then she had any incentive to do anything like that. When Acorn decided at the end of the fourth quarter of 2000 to take the charges that caused Acorn to report a loss for that fourth quarter, that destroyed any chance that any of Acorn's officers had that year for any kind of bonus. They didn't get any. Indeed, they took 20% cuts in their salaries. Now, there wasn't any incentive for Rita McConville to go and misstate what was going on at Acorn from a financial standpoint after that decision had already been made. When we get to the 13B22 issue, the charge of lying to the auditors, once again, we're confronted with what is it that the OIP charged Ms. McConville with doing? What was the false and misleading statement supposedly made by Ms. McConville to the auditors? The OIP clearly says it was in these management representation letters that she signed. The evidence clearly showed that she signed those on April 17th, and the evidence clearly showed she wasn't even an officer on April 17th. So she couldn't have violated the rule even if she had lied. But she didn't lie because the evidence shows that Rita McConville actually believed everything that was in those letters, and there is no evidence that she didn't. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nick Meyer. We'll hear now from Ms. Harden.
May it please the Court. At the outset, I think it's important to clarify the basis of the Commission's 10B findings in this case. Petitioner focuses just on this issue of a footnote disclosure. But in fact, the Commission's decision was broader than that. The Commission found Acorn's 10-K to be materially misleading in two respects. First was the overstatement of the accounts receivable. By failing to either increase the allowance for doubtful accounts, which is indicated in the core financial statements as a subtraction from net assets, or note an impairment, that 10-K represented the full amount of accounts receivable as collectible. And as the Commission found, there was substantial evidence showing that the company was not going to be able to collect that amount. As a result, the company had a duty to disclose that to its investors. Moreover, the failure to make that kind of disclosure, either by an increase in the allowance for doubtful accounts or a footnote, rendered the 10-K statement that the financials were prepared in accordance with GAAP misleading as well. Now, the next question is whether Petitioner McConville can be properly held liable for these misstatements. And I think, Your Honor, you were right in pointing out that Petitioner's involvement goes back prior to her March 20th demotion, as does the evidence that the company was not going to be able to collect all of its accounts receivable. The evidence showed that the negotiations with its largest customer, Cardinal, in fact began in February of 2001, not April, as petitioner contends. Petitioner McConville and the current CEO at that time of the company went to Cardinal, said, "We've got this large dispute. Our records show that you owe us $4 million. Your records show that we owe you $800,000. We need to figure this out." At that time, petitioner presented Cardinal with a series of invoices, raised the issues at this meeting, and by March 9th of 2001, Cardinal had come back and said, "Well, we actually dispute the accuracy of some of these older invoices. They're either paid or we don't have proof that we received the items. And moreover, you know, we're going to pay you $900,000, but we think that's it. And in fact, we think that having made that payment, you now owe us $100,000. This evidence clearly shows, with respect to Acorn's largest company, or I'm sorry, customer, that the company was not going to be able to collect 100% of the accounts receivable. And as a result, in the 10-K, the company had a duty to disclose that.
Now, one of the things you rely a lot on is the fact that there's just 3 days between when this press release she authors is issued and the 10-K is actually filed. Right. I mean, that's one of the points you make. She wasn't charged with making misleading statements in the press release, was she?
No, Your Honor, she was not. The misleading statements at issue here are misleading statements in the 10-K. And McConville was properly held responsible for those because, as the commission found, she reviewed a draft of the 10-K as CFO that was virtually identical to that which was filed. In doing so, she reviews a document, knowing the problems with collectability, she reviews a document that fails to include any amount in the allowance for doubtful accounts attributable to the company's top five customers, which make up 60% of its accounts receivable, and also fails to disclose any problem with collectability.
Now, one of the things counsel says is somehow it was alluded to in the 10-K that these problems existed. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. The commission disagrees with that. What counsel is alluding to, I believe, is an argument that petitioner raised before the commission and has not, in fact, raised before this court. It's an argument about what's called the Bespeaks Caution Doctrine, which is if, in making disclosures to the public, a company provides sufficient cautionary statements that can affect the materiality of the misstatements. The commission dealt with that argument and specifically found that the generalized statements regarding estimates were not sufficient to rise to the level necessary for the Bespeaks Caution Doctrine to apply here. And again, I emphasize, that's not an argument that the petitioner has raised on appeal to this court.
I have just one other question. After she was demoted, is it your position that she had a duty to disclose the material omission in the 10-K?
I want to clarify something at the outset in answering that question. Petitioner makes an argument in her reply brief about the need to prove a duty to speak in omission cases. The cases petitioner is relying on there are silence cases. It's a separate category of 10B case in which an individual remains silent in the presence of a known misstatement by someone else. And in that situation, because the language of 10B refers to making a misstatement, in that situation, courts have required some sort of duty to blow the whistle. This is not a silence case. In this case, the commission's findings are based upon McConville's own misstatements. Based on her role in the creation of the misstatements in the 10K, those statements are attributable to her, and as a result, there's no question of a duty here. Once an individual creates a material misstatement that she knows is going to be distributed to investors, there is a need to prevent that from going to investors. If she knows it's false, if she has the requisite scienter, which McConville had here, she had to stop that misstatement from being disseminated to investors.
Let me ask you this. Was there some statement she made to the auditors that she didn't want to be linked to the substance of the 10-K or to the information provided in the 10-K?
I think what Your Honor is referring to is there was some testimony that when the auditors presented the management representation letters to McConville on April 17th for her signature, she said, well, you know, I didn't do the 10-K. And this is the only evidence in the record on this point. And they said, well, we want you to sign these management representation letters anyway. Now, keep in mind that those management representation letters are statements that not only the financials as they exist are in accordance with GAAP, but that the auditors have been given all of the material information that may have arisen since the end of their field work. Whether or not McConville was involved in the finalization of the 10-K immediately before its filing doesn't affect the fact that she had material knowledge that was not disclosed to the auditors. The full scope of the discrepancy with Cardinal, in addition to the difficulties that had arisen in collecting from Cardinal by that point, were not disclosed. So that statement to the auditors doesn't obviate the falsity of her statements, nor does it in any way diminish her role in the creation of the misstatements in the 10-K. I also want to address petitioner's point with respect to the jurisdictional means requirement of Section 10B. Petitioner makes a contention that that requirement is only met if McConville herself uses jurisdictional means or explicitly deputizes someone to do so. That's not the way courts have interpreted the jurisdictional means requirement. That requirement has actually been interpreted quite broadly to be met whenever someone sets in motion a course of action that will foreseeably result in the use of jurisdictional means. In this case, McConville created misstatements for inclusion in a 10-K that was very foreseeably going to be filed pursuant to jurisdictional means with the commission. And as a result, the jurisdictional means requirement is met in this case. With respect to petitioner's argument that she did not make the misstatements in the 10-K, petitioner alludes to the Supreme Court's decision in Central Bank of Denver. That was a private securities action case in which the Supreme Court determined that aiding and abetting liability is not covered in the language of Section 10B. And the Supreme Court did say to be primarily liable, an individual has to make a misstatement. It didn't go on, however, to define what's required to make a misstatement. And post-Central Bank, the Commission has adopted a standard that if an individual acting alone or with others creates a false statement that reaches an investor, they can be found to have made the misstatement and are therefore primarily liable. In this case, again, McConville's role as CFO in the creation of the statements in the 10-K is sufficient to meet that requirement.
One of counsel's position is that she had no real motivation to aid in the preparation or to further these, quote, false statements, which he even quarrels with that. Is that motivation something that needs to be proven, or did the commission comment on that?
The argument petitioner is making in that respect is a scienter argument that she didn't have an intent to deceive. This court and just about every other court have found that recklessness is enough to satisfy the scienter requirement for 10B. And in this case, there's substantial evidence that McConville knew it was unlikely the company was going to collect the full amount of accounts receivable. And given the importance of accounts receivable to the financial health of the company, the failure to disclose that creates an obvious risk of misleading investors. And that obviousness is enough under this court's Sunstrand decision to satisfy the recklessness standard. Moreover, McConville's signature on the management representation letters, as well as her reaffirmation of the accuracy of the 10-K to the incoming CFO, both show an intent to receive. She was given an intent to deceive. She was given the opportunity to correct the statements that she created before they were disseminated to investors and chose not to do so, all of which goes to scienter. With respect to the Section 13b2-2 claim that petitioner quarrels with, there are a couple of points that are important here. First of all, petitioner focuses solely on the management representation letters and makes an argument that the OIP didn't properly charge her with any other misstatements. I would refer the court in that regard to paragraph L of the OIP, where it specifically alleges that McConville and Respondent Harris failed to provide the auditors with the full information with respect to the discrepancy with Cardinal and failed to disclose that collection wasn't going as well as perceived. In addition, it specifically charges that McConville made a representation to the auditors that old invoices were going to be offset by new credits, and therefore there weren't significant past due amounts. All of those are misstatements that the Commission relied on in its Rule 13b2-2 finding, all of which were properly noticed in the OIP. The Commission, under Rule 13b2-2, relies on those misstatements as well as the management representation letters. Now, with respect to those letters, McConville makes a couple of arguments as to why they're not actionable. The first of which is that the letter contains a boilerplate disclaimer that the statements in it are made to the best of the signer's knowledge and belief. In this respect, it's important to note that there is no scienter requirement for a violation of Rule 13b2-2, and that's discussed specifically in the Commission's release adopting that rule. It specifically declines to adopt a scienter requirement. And in this case, the Commission found that McConville knew or was reckless in not knowing that the statements in those letters were false. And that kind of boilerplate disclaimer can't obviate such a finding. If the court were to rule that a disclaimer like that obviates liability under Rule 13b2-2, it would eviscerate the rule. Every officer and director would simply include disclaimers in every statement they give to auditors. McConville also argues that she was not an officer at the time she signed these letters on April 17th. And it's important to note, again, that there is evidence in the record that McConville was appointed controller upon her demotion from the position of CFO. There is a press release issued by the company saying she was appointed controller. But regardless of the issue of whether she was actually appointed controller, under the Commission's regulations, the performance of functions commensurate with those of an officer is sufficient to be deemed an officer under this rule. Now, and this is a rule that goes to the integrity of the audit, and in this case, McConville had significant access to information important to the integrity of the audit here. She had been one of the principal contacts with the auditors throughout her tenure as CFO and during their field work. After her demotion, she continued to work on the reconciliation of the accounts receivable, and as a result had unique access almost to the knowledge that auditors sought in these letters, which is, are the statements and representations made to us before still true, and has anything changed? And in undertaking to sign those letters, McConville is undertaking to make representations on behalf of the management of the company to the auditors, which is a function commensurate with that of an officer, and the Commission found that was sufficient for her to be deemed an officer and to have violated Rule 13b2-2 in this case. I believe I've addressed everything that the petitioner raised with the court. If you have no other questions, I'll conclude.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Harden.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Nickmeyer have?
2.5 minutes. The last time I looked, Your Honor, the Commission had not amended Rule 10b-5 subsequent to Central Bank. What has happened is that the Commission has made an effort in other cases to pursue the same sort of tenuous claims against people and failed. Most recently, the case of SEC versus Lucent. That case, the defendant, a CFO at the time the financial statements were issued and published didn't actually have a role in the publication of the financial statements. And the court said, in light of Central Bank and its progeny, can't get her on a direct violation. Might be able to get her on an aider and abettor. Might be able to get her on causing, but can't get her on a direct violation. When the commission chose to charge Ms. McConville in this case, it charged her with a direct violation, and it didn't make that case. It couldn't make that case. There's some other things that counsel suggested that I take extreme issue with. There was a suggestion that the record shows that Deloitte didn't know about these negotiations with Cardinal and the other information. The record actually shows that there was an auditor sitting in a room in an office at Acorn, a guy named Jim Vestweber, with this consultant, Jack Mayer. When Ms. McConville was giving her reports to Jack Mayer about the payment from Cardinal, about Cardinal's position that it was now in a credit position, and about Cardinal's position on the invoices, Jim Vestweber was sitting there in the room hearing what was being said between my client and Jack Mayer. Deloitte knew exactly what was going on. Deloitte was on top of this, and Deloitte properly concluded that under the circumstances, there was not a reason to include this footnote that the commission argues ought to be in there. Insofar as the issue under 13B22 is concerned, the question with this disclaimer...
Let me just go back to that point for a minute, because with respect to Deloitte and their role, there are specific findings by the commission that McConville made certain false representations to Deloitte concerning these documents. I mean, I recognize looking at the facts that the, you know, particularly some of the facts counsel addressed as well were found against you by the commission.
The commission saying something doesn't make it so. There has to be evidence in the record, substantial evidence, and there wasn't any substantial evidence of that. I see my time is up. I request that the court look carefully at the OIP and compare that to what counsel described in her argument, because I think they are materially different. For all of the reasons that we've said in our brief, we request that the opinion and order of the commission be set aside in their entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dickmeyer. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case for fine briefs and oral argument today. The case will be taken under advisement.